And we're at the house of Mike Kirby. Mike, lovely to see you again. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Okay, now, this whole programme is about people arriving to Brittany, people leaving, but you are a little bit different because you're staying put in central Brittany. Now, could you tell us a little bit about your particular history, your recent history?
My recent history? Well, my recent history means that I'm a semi-cripple and I have trouble negotiating different places because I was paralysed on my left-hand side after a stroke.
Okay, when was that, Mike?
That was 3 years ago.
Okay, just for listeners' benefit, Mike is actually in his wheelchair at the minute. I think you manage incredibly well. You've adapted your house a little bit. You've got a ramp which enables you to get into your TV room. Stairs are a difficulty, but you manage that incredibly very well. So what has your recent journey been like? What about the kind of medical support you've had? Could you just say a little bit about that?
Well, the medical support in the hospital was absolutely brilliant. Because although they didn't take, they didn't quickly rush me into hospital and start treating me, which I felt was perhaps the wrong thing to do. I felt I needed instant attention to minimise the effects of the stroke.
So were you actually in this house at the time?
No.
When you had the stroke? Whereabouts were you?
I was at a friend's house up the road.
Ah, okay. And so what happened? Did the friend ring a hospital or a doctor?
Well, I had the stroke and then I drove my car down here to my house, parked it and came in, and my friend in the meantime phoned an ambulance and the ambulance came and took me to hospital.
So how long was it before they realised you'd had a stroke?
Well, they knew I'd had a stroke straight away.
Yeah, so I wonder why. You say they should have been slightly more urgent with their medical intervention.
Yeah, yeah. It seemed to me, looking back, that a lot of time elapsed before actually people started treating me. And yes, when I see people with strokes on television, the urgency to get something done and to minimise the effects of the stroke seems to be very important.
Everybody knows that. It seems very strange that there was any kind of delay. But ultimately, they gave you fairly effective treatment in the hospital. You were quite happy with that.
Yeah.
And then what happened, though? Because you were asked to leave the hospital?
After a time, the people in the hospital said that you're not getting any better or you've reached a plateau of what you can do. We'll send you on a course. And they sent me on a course.
I remember it was in that very good rehabilitation centre in Pleme, is that the one, Pleme?
Yeah.
Right. And we came to visit you there, didn't we? You enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But after that, what happened then?
Well, once I got to a certain level, it more or less stayed that way. Although I am getting slightly better at things like memory are causing a problem because I can forget things quite easily now. Whereas before, I used to pride myself on my memory in that I could learn lists, which I had for my job, because I was a rep, and I need to know certain things and be able to call them immediately to mind.
I know your memory used to be very good, and in fact, in some areas it still is very good, isn't it? For example, music.
Oh, yeah.
Your musical recall is still excellent, I think.
Yeah.
But then you were sent to an EPAD. And I think a lot of people might be interested to know that the experience can be quite damaging financially, if nothing else. So could you tell us how long you were in the EPAD? Firstly, the EPAD, of course, it's kind of sheltered housing, isn't it? Where you have staff who come and feed you and look after you.
Yeah.
But it's very expensive. Could you say a little bit about your experience there?
Yes, I think that when I was in hospital, I had two operations lined up, one of them being the old prostate operation that I was needing. And they said, well, never mind about that. We need your bed and you've got to go to EPAD, which is only down the road.
It's an adjoining building.
In fact. So I said, well, all right, I don't have much choice on this. I'm being pushed out in my bed, you know, trundled down the road into the next past the hospital.
Not much dignity there.
Yeah. No, it's true. But dignity, you know, is lost in hospital. What I didn't realise, and what the civil servant who shifted me there didn't realise, was that as soon as I went into EPAD, all my insurance cover, my medical insurance cover, was void.
Well, that's very important to know, isn't it? There must be a lot of people. You presumably didn't know that anyway when you were there. I wouldn't have known.
My insurance cover was here in my house, you know. There was a clause that said that.
So how long were you in the EPAD for?
Not very long, because I escaped.
Basically. Sounds like a high security prison. But
when I did escape, they landed me with a bill of €6,000 for my medical cover.
That's an enormous bill.
Yeah.
For a couple of months, maybe 2 or 3 months.
For 2 months.
Yeah. 2 months, 6,000. Yeah. Right. People ought to know, I think, that as far as I understand, the situation in France is that if you are very ill, you need urgent treatment, you'll get it.
Yes.
But they will drain you of your savings completely.
Yes.
And in fact, when they've finished your savings, they will maybe ask your dependents.
Oh, they will. Yeah.
And presumably, Mike, is that a reason why you've decided to stay, so as not to be a burden to Simon, your son?
No. I was perturbed that it was costing me €2,000 a month, and my house was sitting empty, and I was certain that I could handle living at home because I was getting more and more used to being crippled and finding ways of getting around it. So I escaped, basically, and said, look, I'm going back to my house. I'm not paying any more money. And so in the end, they had to give in.
So you were signed off officially. That's good. Well, I must say, when I visited you, the majority of people in other wards were asleep or were in a kind of almost vegetative state. The TV was on in the common room and there was no one paying the blindest attention. So it's not a particularly stimulating environment to be in.
No.
I think you're probably much better off here. You have your television, your videos, your friends coming to visit occasionally.
It's true.
So anyway, we ought to explain that before coming to Brittany, you were in the south of France. So whereabouts were you exactly?
I was near Narbonne.
Narbonne,
Narbonne and Carcassonne.
Would that be on the coast?
No.
Right. So how was life different in Narbonne, or where you were, to life in central Brittany?
Well, basically, Narbonne was too hot, or it got too hot with the global warming. Because when I first went to the south of France with my wife, we loved coming to France every year for the heat, for the sunshine. And we used to love going back with a beautiful tan. Because we used to go to the naturist beach and go all over the tan. It was wonderful. So when we thought about coming to live in France, the south was the natural place to go, and we loved it. But the global warming was certainly apparent to us because after a time it got oppressive. And I understand from friends now who still live down there, it has now become ludicrously hot in summertime. In that they get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, do what they have to do, go back to bed with the air conditioner on until the evening when it gets cooler in, because during the day it's impossible.
It's an incredibly long siesta, isn't it, if you have to go to bed at presumably 11 o'clock or something and resurface again at what, 4 o'clock?
Yeah.
So whereabouts are you from in the UK, Mike?
Birmingham. Yeah.
So, Mike, what are your favourite experiences of living in Brittany? If you had to just pick one or two memories, what would the top memories be?
One of my favourite experiences was actually getting out of EPAD. Yeah, because I was determined to leave, and they were equally determined to keep me there. And I managed to beat them all.
That's interesting, isn't it? Obviously, you value your independence more highly than everything else.
Yes, exactly.
Could you tell us a fairly humorous story once about two helpers that came when you were already up. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. Well, there are various organisations here in France, thankfully, that do look after people like me, and with different levels of control and support. I mean, support is all very well, control is not so good, as far as I'm concerned. And the one group that offered to help me, they sent along two girls, or they said, we were going to send two girls to come and help you in the morning. And I said, oh, that sounds nice. Right, we'll do that. So they said, well, within the next week or so, these girls will come and assess you and see what help we can give you. Okay. So anyway, the door knocks one day, and these two girls were there, and they said, we're from this organisation. And I said, oh, very good. They said, we didn't really expect to find you up and dressed. And I said, well, that's what I do, you know. And they said, well, we thought we'd have to come and get you up, dress you, you know, wash you, dress you, prepare your breakfast, all that sort of thing. I said, well, you could have done if you'd have got here a bit earlier. And so anyway, they said, well, it's all done now. We were supposed to do that. But as you've done it, is there anything else you want? I said, well, as it happens, yes. I said, because I've run out of coffee. And breakfast without coffee is just terrible to even think about.
Agreed.
I said, so what I'd like you to do is to take this jar of coffee, this empty jar, and get exactly the same one. Here's the money. Oh, we can't do that. You can't do that. And they said, no. I said, why can't you do that? Because we're not empowered to do that.
It's not part of their job description.
Yeah. So I said, okay, well, if that's the case, you either get this coffee for me. And they came in two cars. They had a car each. I said, so one of you can go and the other one stay here. I said, or you can both go. Choose. And they went. They both went.
They disappeared. Never to be seen again.
No.
They made good robots, didn't they?
They were frightened to death of the person in charge. And when I went to, she actually came to see me, and I could see why they were frightened. She was formidable. But, she didn't cut much ice with me, I'm afraid. So it was one of those things where the intent of the help was somehow diluted to such an extent that it wasn't a help at all. They should ask, what do you need? What do you want? What's your biggest problem?
Mike, we'll have to wind it up fairly soon. So, Mike, thank you very much for telling us your story. Yeah. And we wish you all the very best in the future.
Thank you very much.